Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Southern California and Denver, Colorado, and earned a master's degree in journalism from Michigan State University. He's been a writer for the Las Vegas Sun and the Detroit Free Press. Since 2000, with his theoretically humorous look at life, he's been a columnist for the Detroit News. And since 2004, he's been the writer for the nationally syndicated comic strip, Gil Thorpe. A modern-day Charles Corot. His name? Neil Rubin. And I'm Jack Brasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Brasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Neil Rubin. And we read him 4 days a week in the Detroit News. Neil, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Jack, I'm honored to be here. Thank you very much.
And a longtime friend.
Indeed.
Can we start by talking about your childhood, Neil?
Sure.
And your mom and your dad.
An interesting couple. Both gone now. Five, 6 years ago. But they both grew up in New York and got married. And the first thing they did was move as far away from New York as humanly possible. And since no one was going to Hawaii in the early 1950s, they stopped in California. My mother had she had a master's in English and most of a master's in library science. Nobody would hire her to teach junior college, which is what she wanted. So she went to work for Manville Corporation, the folks who brought you asbestosis, and started as a secretary after we moved to Denver, which was when I was a junior in high school. And she wound up running the risk management department. So before women were breaking that glass ceiling, she broke it in a field she had no background in whatsoever. My dad was an aerospace engineer, and that gene definitely skipped, I can tell you that. But he worked on the space program. He worked on Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, wound up retiring from the National Park Service. He would do the electrical design for new visitor centers at Yosemite, things like that.
What's the biggest thing, Neil, you learned from Mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Dad?
You know, from Mom, it might have been, from both of them, love of the language. For my mom, it might have been grammar, because when she was mad at me for some horrendous thing I'd done, and, you know, this was not an uncommon occurrence, and she'd be barking at me, as parents need to do, it's part of the job description, you could see the sentences come out of her mouth perfectly formed. You could indent the paragraphs. She spoke in perfect English at all times. It was just amazing. My dad, just fundamental decency and honesty. And, you know, in small ways. But I remember as a little kid, somebody gave him too much change. I don't remember what store we were visiting, but someone gave him too much change. We walked out. He looked at it, counted it again, walked back into the store to give the guy the difference, which was probably, you know, 37 cents. But that made an impression.
Neil, when you were a kid, did you see and did you ask about interesting and unique stories?
I did. I've just always been curious. I've always been interested in people's stories, and everybody has one. And somebody once told me I had an Ann Landers face. People just, you know, strangers on the bus want to tell me about their life, which is great because I'm interested in hearing it.
Well, that's better than me. Johnny Giannopoulos says I have a face for radio. So, when did you know you wanted to be a writer?
Third grade. I was an early reader. It's the advantage of having a brother about 20 months older. You know, he was learning to read, so, well, heck, I wanted to do what he was doing. And so I was already reading and writing when I started kindergarten. By first grade, they tell me I was writing plays, and I'm sure they were, you know, if I look back now, I'd be embarrassed beyond measure. But we had a newspaper in third grade class, and I wound up the editor, and something touched me in there. Something sparked.
We read you, Neil, on Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday. And I've been around you a lot of times, and we're doing something. We're listening to somebody, and you pull out this little pad. It's 3x5 and maybe an eighth of an inch thick. And every 15 minutes or so, you write one or two words. And the next morning, there's the story. How do you do it?
Well, the little pad is more for jotting down ideas. Every now and again, I'll, you know, somebody will say something in conversation. I'll think, hey, there could be a column in that. Or a car will drive by with an interesting bumper sticker, and I'll scribble that down just because you never know when I'll do something with it. Maybe I'll find half a dozen of them and be able to build a column item around it. You know, it's sort of like being a cab driver. I'm never off duty, which drives my wife a little bit nuts now and again. But, you know, I try not to conduct full-scale interviews in social settings. I, you know, try to just maybe make appointments to do that later on.
Couple examples.
Sure.
Many, many years ago, Coleman Young dies. And you find out what cemetery he's going to be buried in, and you go out there ahead of time. Why?
I did. I wanted... It's sort of a philosophy. When you're looking at a big story and saying, okay, what's my small part of this big story? I think, who's going to get their hands dirty? And in this case, it was literal. I went out and talked to the two guys who were digging Coleman Young's grave. And I was just curious. You know, they dig, it was Elmwood, I believe, and they, you know, these guys are busy all year long. But I thought, do you have a sense of being a part of history here? Your little piece of this momentous event. Because we lose track of it. Coleman Young was a massive historical figure. He's such a hot button here that we forget that. The guy was in the World Book Encyclopedia. And yes, these two white guys from distant Macomb County, they were absolutely aware that they were playing a role in history, and it was vitally important to them. Still remember those guys.
Recently, you went to a U of M game in Ann Arbor. And you're walking through the tailgate parties with tens of thousands of cars, and you see a car with an Ohio vanity license plate, and it says...
M Go Blue.
So what do you do?
Well, I wrote a note on a business card, tucked it in the guy's window, and said, you're the bravest man in Ohio. Call me. Well, I think he actually called me from the traffic jam getting out of the game. He didn't leave his number. I'm still trying to find him. I at least have his name, and it's not Smith. But I'm running through Ohio trying to track this guy down. And next time I go to a game, if I can find the car, and I looked a couple weeks ago, I didn't see it. But if I can find the car, he's getting another note.
If you're listening tonight, get a hold of Neil. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Krasula, and we're with Neil Rubin. And Neil has a doctorate degree in people. Neil, you're a world-class listener. Talk to us about the art of listening.
Well, from a newspaper perspective, first off, you've got to be willing to let somebody else be the star. You know, particularly in an interview situation, I want to establish a flow in a conversation, but I don't need to have a better story than your story. And really, in general, I try not, you know, it's human nature. You get in a conversation, somebody tells a story, you've got a story, and you find people trying to top each other. I know my stories. I've heard them 1,000 times. I want to hear yours.
Marcy's heard them 10,000 times.
Oh, minimum.
Another person that had that in spades was the late, great Bob Talbert. Talk to us about Bob Talbert.
Bob was amazing. Bob related to readers better than anyone I have ever worked with. And he wasn't an artful writer. You know, around the newsroom, people would, you know, he'd do some of this corny stuff, or he'd do Bob being Bob again, or it was a slow day. Bob would call Jeff Daniels, You could tell when Bob didn't have anything else to write about, he'd call Jeff Daniels. He did Jeff 20 times a year. Well, Jeff is a great interview. He's a hilarious, funny, interesting guy doing interesting stuff. But anyway, what Bob did was make people feel comfortable and make people feel like they were a part of things. And like you said, he did it better than anyone I've ever known. And he did it relentlessly. I'm in the paper 3 times a week, sometimes online Sunday. Bob would write 6 columns a week. Now, sometimes he'd just rewrite a couple press releases and string them together, but I don't care if you're, you know, if you're in the paper 6 times a week and you want to copy the yellow pages for one of those columns, you have my permission.
On August 20th of this past year, heaven just got a whole lot more interesting. This is a quote from one of his sons. We lost the late, great Elmore Leonard. And you loved him.
I did.
Tell us about Elmore Leonard.
Elmore Leonard was an amazing guy. I quote Elmore to people as an inspiration, as fuel, in a couple of different ways. For people who say, and I hear this all the time, oh, I'd love to write, but I don't have the time. Elmore started out getting up at 5 in the morning and writing. At the time, he was mostly writing Western short stories because that's what was selling in the 50s. He'd get up at 5 a.m. and write for 2 hours before his kids got up and everybody started getting ready for school and work. So if you want to write, you can. Elmore found the time. With a house full of kids, you can find the time. The other great Elmoreism was for writers who sell a book, to, as Elmore so often did, to movies or television. Once you cash the check, he'd say, it's not your book anymore, it's their movie. So if it's a good movie, fabulous, it's a bonus. If it's a bad movie, what do you care? The check cleared. He really drew that line, and writers need to be able to do that. In terms of Elmore himself, Elmore the personality, funny, wry, generous. He knew how good he was. He didn't have to tell you how good he was. And he lived life, particularly the last 20, 30 years, completely on his own terms. He wasn't arrogant. He wasn't that guy charging into a restaurant saying, do you know who I am? And in fact, he was the opposite of that. He would not tell you who he was. If he wanted to do something, he did it. If he didn't want to do it, he didn't do it. He was Elmore Leonard. He didn't have to.
He was the Charles Dickens of Detroit.
I think that's fair.
He had his 10 rules of writing, the Reader's Digest version, and the last one. The most important rule is one that sums up the 10. If it sounds like writing, I rewrite it.
Yes, there are some words, and we could live with that. We could have more of that in the newspaper business, too. There are some words you read in a newspaper that you just never read anywhere else. Where else does somebody ink a pact? Or where else is some Banana Republic dictator the Panamanian strongman? You know, real people don't talk like that, and I try to use words that real people use.
The homily that the priest gave that Saturday was, the title was 3 words, Return to Sender. And the other thing that amazed me was seeing you and Marcy across the church, and you were in a suit, a white shirt, and a tie, Neil Rubin, I didn't even know you had a white shirt, a suit, and a tie. You really love the man.
I love the man, and in terms of the shirt and the suit and the tie, about one of each. I do have more ties than that. You just don't see them very often. I did. I adored Elmore, and it was a treat to be able, you know, to call him a friend. And like I said, he had no ego involvement in being Elmore Leonard. I didn't have ego involvement in being Elmore Leonard's friend. I just knew how special it was when we were able to spend time together. And sometimes the phone would ring at work, and I'd pick up the phone, and he'd say, Neil, it's Dutch. I need a hockey bar downtown with a payphone where 2 hitmen can be waiting for a call from their lawyer. And I'd say, oh, you'd want this one and that one. And it was fun to kind of be Elmore's under-assistant leg man.
So He was a great storyteller. Neil Rubin, you are a great storyteller. Why do people love stories so much?
It's something we can all relate to. Heck, you know, and we all have stories. They're not necessarily as good as we think they are, but we all have a story. And I think we all enjoy a story. Maybe this goes all the way back to when language was first developing and you're, you know, sitting around a fire in the cave hoping hoping a woolly mammoth will wander by for dinner. And somebody's got a story. It's just how humans relate.
If the greatest storytellers get the best spots in heaven, our own Mitch Albom is going to be in one of the best spots in heaven. What makes Mitch Albom so special?
Mitch is, well, from a professional standpoint, which isn't where you were going, he's maybe the fastest good writer I've ever known. He and a fellow named Marty Cohn, who Free Press readers will recognize, he was there for a long time. It's like the great phrases just come spilling out of his fingertips. You know, he could do it hang gliding. As a writer, he just has a way of drawing you into whatever scene he's setting. He puts you there. He puts you in the seat. He puts you in the place. You're there at Maury's bedside, you know, wiping away the crumbs from his lips and, you know, leaning in to hear what he's going to say next.
We're talking to Neil Rubin, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with a modern-day Charles Kuralt, our own Neil Rubin. Neil, Johnny Carson, legendary, and Regis Philbin, who was the sidekick with Joey Bishop's, who's now on this Fox All Sports channel. Talk to us about Carson and Regis.
Very interesting opposites who do very much the same thing with the same level of effectiveness. Johnny Carson was famously shy. When he wasn't on the air, he was almost reclusive. And he wasn't grumpy about it. It was just who he was and how he lived. On the air, he was brilliant. He was quick-witted. He started out, like a lot of these guys do, as Leno Letterman. He was a stand-up comedian. A great interviewer, as it turned out. And he looked incredibly comfortable in that chair or doing that monologue. But off the air, that wasn't who he was at all. With Regis, you get the sense that's exactly who he is. I said earlier that strangers on a bus will just tell me their life stories. Regis would get on a bus and start asking people for their life stories. He is completely outgoing. He's interested. He loves being Regis. He loves being the center of attention. And in his own way, he's the modern Johnny Carson without being anything like Johnny Carson.
Leno and Letterman.
The same thing. I have never met David Letterman. I've talked to Jay Leno a couple times. Incredibly generous guy. If you love cars, you're his friend. And if you're a struggling comedian, you're his friend. And Letterman just goes home after work.
The rest of the story was made famous by Paul Harvey. Tell us about Paul Harvey.
Paul Harvey was sort of the radio Bob Talbert. He just connected with people at an elemental level. He had an innate knowledge of what people were interested in and was endlessly imitable. If there's inimitable, there must be imitable. But he was imitatable, which also helps. Ed Sullivan, after a while, I've read, got to the point where he was imitating the people who imitated Ed Sullivan. With Paul Harvey, isn't it great for your radio show if everybody's doing a Paul Harvey impression? Now you're tuning into Paul Harvey again. He quoted my column a couple of times over the years, and I'm not going to lie, I got a huge kick out of that.
He used to, when people would come up to him and say, you know, I remember your story about this or this or this, his answer would be, how nice of you to remember.
Yes. And there are times where somebody has come up to me and said, oh, I remember your column about such and such, or I was in your column about such and such. And I confess it has taken me a few minutes for the mental file cards to go flipping through my brain so I can remember that column, because I'm always focused on the next three. I might not remember specifically what I wrote last week without a reminder.
Speaking about somebody where we remember what they say, let me give you some quotes. The future ain't what it used to be. There ain't no future living in the past. Oh, that place is so busy, ain't nobody goes there anymore. It's deja vu all over again. It ain't over till it's over. The one-of-a-kind Yogi Berra.
Who I only knew from afar. Heck, you've met Yogi and spent time with him. And you can, you know, because you've told me great stories, that's the real Yogi. He's not some media creation. This is Yogi 24 hours a day. But, you know, well, for one thing, baseball fan to baseball fan, people forget what a spectacular baseball player he was. To me, probably the second best catcher of all time. But he's a reminder in this corporatized sports world where we know everybody's salary and we know their foibles and we know every time they get pulled over for DUI. Yogi never stopped being a kid. He was kid-sized and he talked like a kid and he kind of had a kid mug. And Yogi sort of represented everything we love about sports.
Speaking of sports, in 2004, you get the job to write the comic strip for Gil Thorpe. Neil, how did that ever happen?
Well, it's a long story that I'll try to condense a little bit, but when I started at the Free Press hired me out of Las Vegas in 1984. Part of the hiring process was you had to critique the newspaper. They told me later that I was the only applicant they'd ever had whose critique included a critique of the comic section. I like comics. I read the comic section, so I critiqued it, and I remember specifically making fun of Gil Thorpe and Dondi, which they were also running at the time. I said, for goodness sake, at least join the 70s. Well, I get to the Free Press, and everybody is a Gil Thorpe fan. Gil Thorpe and Brenda were sort of cult figures at the Free Press, to the point where when Gil got married in the strip in 85 or 86, we had a wedding reception at the paper. And so I got swept up in it, started taking every excuse I possibly could to write about, significant milestone Gil Thorpe anniversaries or Gil Thorpe books and products, which a fella in suburban Chicago was turning out then every year or two. So it got to the point when the syndicate was looking for someone to take over the strip. I'm the second writer after Jack Barrel, the originator, died. Syndicate was looking for somebody, and my name came up just because I'd become so associated with Gil Thorpe.
Milford High School is the coach, athletic director. Neil, where do you come up with the characters, the coaches, the players, and who do you figure out are the winners, the losers, and the goats?
That's all part of the fun. It's sort of like being the director and the screenwriter of a movie, because I write every word that appears in the strip 6 days a week, three panels a day, and you're trying to move a story along in three panels a day and create personalities. I'm also the director in that I tell the artist what I want the picture to look like, you know, what I need him to draw for each panel. In terms of character names, a lot of times I use my friends. It's the great joy of writing the strip is being able to toss my friends in there. Or the coach I really didn't like in high school, he was a villain. I try not to have him win all the time. That's not realistic. And you don't learn anything from winning all the time. And Gil, I think, would tell you more than anything else, he's a teacher. You learn from winning, you learn from losing, you learn from dealing with different personalities. And that's part of the fun for me, to draw all that out in the strip.
We're talking to Neil Rubin. Neil, have you figured out yet what they're going to do in this year's football season and basketball season?
Well, I'm about halfway through football season. And once again, you know, I hate to spoil the surprise for anybody, I don't think Milford's going to win the Valley Conference. In fact, I just finished a week that had them losing 7-6 in the slop, in a mud bowl. But we've got a couple interesting characters I like, and sometimes it's like Elmore said, he creates characters and turns them loose, and sometimes he's surprised at where they go. So sometimes I know when I start a season exactly where it's going to end up, and sometimes I'm curious like everybody else.
Neil, you don't have an enemy in the world, but you've been banned for life from WWE wrestling. Why?
I confess, I'm so proud of this story that it's on my resume. In 87, what was then the WWF brought WrestleMania III to the Pontiac Silverdome. And we weren't interested in it as a sporting event, but as a lifestyle event. If you're going to get 90,000 people in a building to watch wrestling with ringside seats, $100 in 1987 money, okay, now we're interested. And I got really curious about Hulk Hogan. You know, I knew his mom didn't name him that. And so I called the publicist for WWF and said, hey, I know everybody's busy this week, but if I could get 5 or 10 minutes on the phone with Hulk, I'd sure, you know, even if it's on the phone, I'd sure appreciate it. And he said, what do you want to talk to him about? I said, well, I just want to know who he was before he became Hulk Hogan. And the guy got immediately huffy. Well, Hulk is Hulk and no one else. And if that's what you want to talk to him about, no, you can't talk to him. Can you think of anything stupider to say to a reporter? No, you cannot have this information. And this was pre-internet, so the chase was kind of fun. But I found a reference to his real name, which is Terry Jean Bollea. I found a reference to where he's from, which was Tampa, Florida. Started digging and, you know, just turning over the rocks and doing all the things reporters do. Wound up tracking him all the way back to his Little League coach. When Hulk Hogan was 12 years old, he was 6 feet tall and weighed 198 pounds. Now, can you imagine? When I was 10, I was in that upper division playing against 11 and 12-year-olds. There were two 10-year-olds on each of what they call the major league teams. Can you imagine? You're 10 years old, and I was, you know, I'm 5'6 now. You can imagine I was not a massive 10-year-old. And you're at home plate in a Little League game, 46 feet away from the pitcher. And the guy's out there, and he's bigger than your dad. So anyway, I wrote all that. He streaked the high school graduation when he was a junior, for instance. He put a stocking over his head and ran across the football field. He was 6'8 and 290 pounds. Do you think they knew who it was? Anyway, so I just wrote all this. And, you know, he's a good guy, and that's what the story said. But it got to Hulk's background. WWF was furious, and I am now banned.
We're talking to Neil Rubin. We still love him, even though he's banned from WWF. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to the person that we read Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday in the Detroit News, our own Neil Rubin. Neil, let's talk about some fabulous human beings. Number one, Eleanor Josaitis.
She would smack you upside the head if you said this in her hearing, but she was a saint on earth. She was feisty, she was fabulous, she did more good for more people than almost anybody you can point to around here. She was the co-founder, for people who don't immediately recognize the name, of Focus Hope, the social justice and social service agency in Detroit. And she got the job done. She was amazing.
This next one, the Wizard of Westwood, John Wooden, some quotes. You can't live a perfect day without doing something for someone who will never be able to repay you. Happiness begins when selfishness ends. Talent is God-given. Be humble. Fame is man-given. Be grateful. Conceit is self-given. Be careful. Neil John Wooden.
The thing people forget about John Wooden is he didn't sort of grow up and immediately begin winning NCAA basketball championships at UCLA. He scuffled for a while. He coached other places. He was at UCLA for a while before that program became nationally prominent. He worked hard for what he had. And he, you know, sort of that, we keep going back to Elmore Leonard, somebody who was pleased with what he had done, but not impressed with himself for doing it. And I think one of the real indicators of John Wooden is it's not just the stars who played for him, who speak reverently about him. It's the scrubs and the people you never heard about.
Mother Teresa, a quote, "I am a little pencil in the hand of a writing God who was sending a love letter to the world." Neil, Mother Teresa.
Somebody, you know, what are the chances that a nun, I believe a non-English-speaking nun, who spent basically her entire career hidden in the worst ghettos of India, a country that very few of us have ever been to and fewer of us understand, she would become globally famous? That's just astonishing to me. And, you know, she lived her philosophy more than almost anybody else you could think of.
Just a couple weeks ago, there was a long article in a Jesuit magazine. And the interviewer says, "I asked Pope Francis point blank the first question, who is Jorge Maria Bergoglio? He stares at me in silence. I ask him if I may ask this question. He nods and replies, I'm a sinner whom God has looked upon." Neil, this new pope, forget Catholics, he's won the respect and the love of the people throughout the world. Why?
He's the guy you would want for your parish priest. And how often does that happen with a pope? I mean, these guys are executives. They've climbed the ladder. It's taken them a long time to do it, and they have a big job. And yet, here's a guy who, you know, you can't even say it's the common touch. It's just he sees himself as the common guy, which is a different thing. If he was your parish priest, you would absolutely love him, whereas his predecessor was seen as sort of stern and maybe autocratic, and it was just who he was, and it was sort of the job that needed doing as he saw doing it. Here's a guy who, now here's a comparison Bob Talbert never would have expected, sort of the Bob Talbert of the papacy, somebody with the total common touch who relates to people effortlessly without trying to do it. It's just who he is.
Talk about relating to people. Our own Ernie Harwell. And in August of 2001, he wrote me his philosophy of life. Can we start by sharing that?
I happen to have it right here. It says, "I am here on earth to serve God. Because his son, Jesus Christ, lives in me, I have a purpose. My aim is to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with God. I must trust him with all my heart, soul, and mind, and let him direct my journey. I am a sinner." There we have that again. "I am a sinner, but can always depend on him to forgive me and let me live life to the fullest."
Why did we love him so much?
Well, he's in your house. He's in your house doing a beloved thing. He wasn't delivering bad news. He was on your radio. He was the voice of summer. He was the voice of your childhood. He became the voice of your kids' childhood. He did it so long. He was a bond to something we all love and treasure. Even if you don't love baseball, you love the idea of baseball, of idyllic summer afternoons and evenings in a big green field. And on top of that, he was completely genuine. It's not like he was faking that. The Ernie you thought you knew from the radio was absolutely the Ernie who you would meet. And, you know, you and I know a lot of front page people just because of what we do and, you know, and the fortunate things we've been able to do in life. I'm pretty much beyond pinch me, but I can tell you a real pinch me moment was sitting in Ernie's living room the few times I did, just talking life and baseball and passing time and, you know, having Ernie lean back and say, you know, "Lulu, can you bring us some of that fine butter pecan ice cream?" And I said, "I'm talking baseball in Ernie Harwell's living room. How cool is this?"
Speaking of baseball, the architect of the Tigers, Dave Dombrowski.
Dave Dombrowski is one of those guys who is absolutely brilliant and will never tell you that. You have to figure it out for yourself. And if you figure it out and you say, geez, Dave, you sure are brilliant, he'll just kind of stammer something and turn away, because that's not who he is. That's not what he's in it for. But he's a wonderful, wonderful guy, a true gentleman, devoted to his family, and a brilliant general manager. In fact, I had a column item a couple of weeks ago pointing out, you know, just what's happened to the six guys who the Tigers traded to get Miguel Cabrera. Two of them are out of baseball. One of them hasn't played in the major leagues since 2011. Two of them have become serviceable relief pitchers, but easily replaceable parts. I mean, and one of them, Cameron Maben, is sort of a, you know, he's sort of Maben the maybe with the San Diego Padres. Basically, he gave up nothing to get the best hitter you or I will ever see. Dave Dombrowski's just staggeringly good.
And you email him, and he answers within 15 minutes.
Yeah.
A phenomenal human being.
Yes.
As our time winds down together, what advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
Well, I get asked a lot, you know, my advice and the great, you know, the great big things is no better than anybody else's. I get asked a lot, though, about what should I do if I want to write, if I want to become a writer. And I feel a little more qualified to expound on that. The best ways to improve as a writer are easy. You read and you write. You read to see what works for you. You read because you subliminally pick up things like spelling and punctuation and grammar. You read to learn who has a rhythm and what rhythm is and how you can develop that yourself. And then writing, you put it all into practice. If you want to be a writer, don't give yourself any excuses. Sit down and write. There's more places now to be published with the internet than ever before. And so there's no excuse not to do it. Do it for your own satisfaction. Do it out of curiosity. But if you want to write, read and write.
And Neil, please keep reading and writing, because you're a Michigan treasure.
Thank you.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahn.